Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zakheim, your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
This episode of Reaganism features a conversation between Roger Zakheim and Senator Tim Scott from the Reagan Institute Summit on Education, which occurred on September 17, 2020. After growing up in a poor single-parent household in North Charleston, South Carolina, Tim Scott rose through the ranks of the South Carolina House of Representatives and the U.S. House of Representatives to join the U.S. Senate in 2013, where his signature legislation included creating opportunity zones as a part of the 2017 tax reform package. Senator Scott and Roger discuss his belief in the importance of school choice, the effectiveness of opportunity zones, and the Senate's role in the ongoing push for law enforcement reform. If you enjoy the conversation, remember to leave us a 5-star review and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Senator, great to have you here, and thanks for participating in RISE. I thought we'd start with what's before the Senate, and that is the next round of relief from the pandemic, obviously the CARES Act. Yes. Much of that has already gone through. What's next on the agenda?
You know, it's really trying to get our friends on the other side to come to the table and to have a discussion about what should be next. And so far, they have been unwilling to do so. We've worked really hard on creating what we call the skinny version of the HEALS Act, which focused on a few tax provisions, increasing the charitable deduction, also something called a School Choice Now Act that will keep kids going to the same schools pre-pandemic. We focused on providing more resources for vaccines and therapies. Unfortunately, there's just been so little cooperation on the other side. What they want and what we want are miles apart, frankly, trillions apart, to be realistic. And it's hard to appreciate the challenge we are facing, the headwinds we're facing on such important legislation. I do think there is a moment of pause that can be helpful to see how the $4 trillion, basically speaking, is impacting the economy, the average person in our country, and then come back to the drawing board. But there's been no one to negotiate with, and that's been disappointing.
Really hard during an election year, right?
100%. Listen, there's all things politics right now. And
right.
Unfortunately, that means for the average person who may be viewing this tape or sitting at home thinking about the future, between now and the election, I don't anticipate anything of substance getting done except for a continuing resolution that will kick the spending decisions after the election.
So your prediction is government will stay open in the form of a continuing resolution, but any more relief from the federal government you don't see happening until after November.
And the president's executive order probably will have been the last big thing on the CARES front or the pandemic front. I thought he was wise to use his flexibility and his authority to extend some benefits for a few more weeks. Reduced amount. I think I had an amendment to change the $600 amount to 100% of your income, because I think ultimately overpaying people to stay home
right.
gives them a very difficult decision to make. Do I stay at home and make more money, or do I go back to work? We should not put the American people in that position. Getting paid what you were making while you were working because of the pandemic while you're at home, there's some logic to that. Being paid more to stay at home, there's no logic.
And of course, you've been very prominent in talking about the dignity of work and
Absolutely.
Creating those opportunities. We'll get to that in a little bit. Let's focus on the education element.
Yes.
I know that the School Choice Now Act is an element of the next round of support for federal government. You just said that you don't see it happening before November. But the relief that's needed, particularly now as Americans are sending their children back to school. We were just talking about this. My kids are learning virtually. You know, there's a challenge in many communities across the country, public school and private schools, not having the resources ability to do that virtually. You know, talk to me a little about the challenge Americans are facing with education in this environment with the pandemic.
Well, unlike you, a lot of parents are not designed to be homeschool parents. That's a hard job, and you have five. So it may be even harder for you than others.
But my wife is laughing right now. There's nobody here homeschooling, but okay, I'll take it.
Yes, and there are a lot of people in my office laughing too, but they don't want to be homeschooled parents. But unfortunately, one of the things we tried to solve in the American my education bill right now is to focus on helping parents keep their kids in the same education environment they were in pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. There's $105 billion in legislation that's designed around you get to choose the school you want for your kid, because the more choice a parent has, the better the chance for success for that child. And that's really the focus we have on the school choice now legislation and why it's a part of the apparatus for the CARES response. The one thing you cannot do is, especially in Title I, which are the poorest schools, the lowest performing schools, unfortunately, in America, the one thing you can't do is keep that kid out of the cycle of success, which is education. Mm-hmm. When you take that child out, it takes so much longer for them to catch up. We have to reinforce the importance of education. And there are a couple of major pillars in the School Choice Now bill. One is, of course, keeping your kid in the same education space they were in pre-pandemic. The other is to encourage folks to contribute to scholarship granting organizations. Businesses and individuals can get a tax credit so that they continue to provide scholarships for kids who absolutely, positively, unequivocally need healthy school options.
Let me drill down. Sure. I'll get on the tax policy component in a moment, but use the language of choice. And, yes. And you're a prominent advocate of school choice. Just for a moment, make the argument, even for the layperson. You yes. know, just the parent who's not an education policy expert, but explain why this leads to the education that our children need in your mind and the prosperity, the opportunity that you focus on all the time. Wow. Give me the connection between choice and the opportunity.
Well, the simple explanation is this, that in many zip codes around the country, quality education is not an option for poor people. Having grown up in a single-parent household mired in poverty, quality education was something that was always concerning to my mother. We moved four times by the time I was in the fourth grade.
Not a military family.
Not a military family. That's hard on a parent to be able to put their child in the right place. Every child deserves quality education. It's just not available everywhere in America.
Right.
So why wouldn't we give the parent the options in their neighborhoods, or at least near their neighborhoods, near their zip codes, mm-hmm. so the child gets the highest quality education? So the short story is, you live in a place where the education is bad. Choice or education reform gives you a chance to go to a school that's good. Your zip code should not determine the quality of your education. School choice simply says, we hear you and we see you, and you have incredible, unlimited potential, and we're going to help you maximize that.
So what are some of those choices?
So it could be private schools, it could be public schools, it could be charter schools, it could be virtual schools, it could be homeschool. What we're saying is, I don't know what works in your mm-hmm. zip code, mm-hmm. but your parents do. So let me give you the resources to make the best choice for your kid. And that's what we really want. We want every child to have quality education because their parent gets to choose the lane that's best for them.
So let's go back to your legislation, the School Choice Now Act.
Yes.
How would it advance choice? What is this notion that in this environment you would have that ability to choose, you know, any of those five options you just
yeah,
articulated?
Absolutely. One thing it does is it says that wherever you were, you get to stay. The second thing, which I think is really important, is my mother, who made a little bit more than minimum wage mm-hmm. all of my childhood, she would not have been able to afford a school choice option for me, even if it was available. So what we do is we have we call them SGOs, scholarship granting organizations, mm-hmm. where you can make a contribution, get a tax credit, and a kid in a Title I school, typically poor kids, have access to those resources so that they too get to go to the school options.
So you look for that scholarship opportunity yeah. if it's a similar situation as you, where you didn't have the ability to pay for one of those choices.
Exactly, because the only people who don't have school choice are poor kids.
Right.
Middle income folks and affluent people have the option to either choose the house in the right school district or send their child to the right school. The only people in America that do not have that choice are poor ones.
Another thing that's happening right now with the pandemic and children going back to school, right, is the decisions at the state or county, local level that, hey, you can't go back to the school because of the risk. We're going to go virtual, right? And give me your take on those communities and those school districts where going virtual is not an option because the broadband's not there, or you don't have the devices. So give me your take on that as well.
You know, I was listening to a radio station last week, and they were having this drive because at one of the Title I elementary schools, the kids that had an iPad or a Chromebook, when they got them back, they weren't in good shape, their covers were gone. Mm. And so they were having a drive to help provide the resources so these kids would have the tools necessary to connect. Now, the first tool that's necessary to connect is broadband. Right. You have to have the connection at your home. And unfortunately, over 40,000 students in South Carolina were lost because of connection issues. How do you get a good education if you can't even get online to your virtual school? You can't. Well, if you can get online, but you don't have the actual physical, tangible resource to get online, what do you do then? We have to help solve those problems. Those are, in my opinion, that's part of the existential threat to America, is having an uneducated group of people who are desperately looking for opportunities. We can do better, and we should do better, and broadband and connection issues are something we should solve.
Is that a federal role? Is there a federal role for addressing it?
I think there is. I think that the fact of the matter is, whether it's in the current environment, as we have just seen the acceleration of the gig economy, as we've seen the advent of telehealth in a way that we've never seen before, I think there is a federal nexus to providing some resources for connection, because it's your education, it's your work, and it's your health.
Great. Last one on the kind of pure education play, but
yes,
you know, the issue of choice and just being kind of a passive watcher of it is obviously hotly debated, and it often not always breaks down along partisan lines. What is the misconception? What is the kind of outlook that you hear from those across the aisle from you with respect to choice that you feel they're missing, or just, you know, you would love to correct? Articulate that for me.
I think sometimes people think that school choice is about middle-income families or wealthy families getting more dollars for their kids to go to school. That's not the way it really is. The way it breaks down is that literally the kids who desperately need more options are the kids that benefit from school choice. Those kids are typically kids attending a Title I school, living in poverty, too often single-parent household, similar to my circumstances. So giving those parents more arrows in the quiver, it just only creates more parity. It levels the playing field, because in education, the field is not level. It's not a racial thing, but it is an income thing.
So, and when they have that opportunity, you know, some of the critique, as I understand it, is that the public school that they're leaving within that zip code that you say we shouldn't be bound by will suffer as well in the form of enrollment and funding. What about those lower performing schools?
I'll say this, a perfect example is in New York, where there is a charter school system called Success Academies. Mm-hmm. They receive about 40 cents on the dollar, and they produce results with I think it's 83 or 93% African-American Hispanic kids outperform the white kids in New York City. So one of the things that we're learning is that with half the money, they produce higher results. So the funding equity question, in my opinion,
not the right metric,
is a rabbit trail. Mm-hmm, it's running down a rabbit trail. We spend $760 or $750 billion K-12 education, and according to our OECD competition, we are mediocre and getting worse. So it's not money. I mean, in South Carolina, Greenville County spends about $9,700 per kid. Fairfield County, Greenville's fairly affluent. Fairfield, one of the poorest counties in South Carolina, $16,000 per student. Mm-hmm. So we have to change the formula and the focus. We need outcomes, not simply a funding conversation, because it's obvious that if you're getting better results at $9,700 than you are $16,000, there may be more to the formula than money.
Got it. Let's transition a bit, because we're talking about opportunity, education, and equity is an element in all this. Just a couple of months ago, you were in the midst of the discussions with regard to your Justice Act bill and responding to the tragedy of Taylor and George Floyd and the civil and just unrest across the country. That bill did not go through. It wasn't adopted by the Senate, though you had a majority. Couple of questions about it. Please, just for those who are watching and listening, talk about what was in that bill and your kind of attempt to get that through the Senate, and then kind of contextualize it with a larger kind of a civil discussion and unrest across the country when it comes to race.
Well, I think one of the things that three major pillars in the Justice Act, some of those pillars very similar to what was in the House passed bill. Number one is the whole data collection. And in order for us to resource the right outcomes, you have to have the right data. This is something that both sides agreed upon. We did not necessarily agree upon when you start collecting the data. Serious bodily injury was my thought. They wanted misdemeanors, traffic stops, and everything else. That's not a bridge too far. We can figure that out. Second area is in resourcing. So it's in the grants that are being provided. We were providing grants for body cameras, de-escalation training, the duty to intervene.
So on the police side to
yeah, sorry,
to point. Improve the training.
Yeah, to improve the training. And then the third part, of course, is how you respond to bad apples. Decertification is part of the conversation. Falsifying police reports is part of the conversation. So in my legislation, we have aspects on how to improve the outcome for the person who's in the middle of the situation, and to make sure that we kept the officers on the right track. The things that were not in our bill were more important than the things that were in our bill to the other side. They wanted to demonize law enforcement. I am not going to do that. How do you demonize the very people that you want to respond to the situations and circumstances that are absolutely at times volatile and explosive? So we have to have an equilibrium.
And you talk about this binary choice that essentially the national discussion fell prey to.
Yes.
On the Senate floor, you said it's a false choice. Explain what that is.
False dichotomy. There is no binary choice between law enforcement and communities of color. You can actually support both, and you should support both. And you do so by having reform legislation that speaks to the outcomes that you want without demonizing one side or the other. If you do not, as African American who's been stopped 18 times in the last two decades, I don't like stereotyping. Don't stereotype me. So why in the world would I stereotype every law enforcement officer? If it's wrong for you to stereotype me, then it should be wrong for me to stereotype you. That's the false dichotomy. That's the binary choice that does not exist.
Where is this going to go next? Are we going to see some legislation? Because there seems to be bipartisan agreement.
Absolutely.
I'll seem very close on the issue.
I've spoken to the Congressional Black Caucus, and they've walked up to Karen Bass later and said, "Tim, your bill is good. We could actually get, if we could get it to conference, we would be able to work towards that." What it takes to get the conference, however, is the Senate Democrats who are involved in presidential politics come to the table, like the CBC was willing to do so, and get this bill to Congress.
So the Congressional Black Caucus is willing to, the Senate Democrats in your mind aren't.
I'm not willing to go for it.
Post-November?
They say in the aftermath of the election, during the lame duck session, is the best chance for success.
And do you think you'll be putting forward the same legislation, some of the modifications that you talked about on the Senate floor? Will there be an updated version?
Well, I'm going to stick with the current bill. I'm happy to amend it some, but I'm not going to amend it. I will not demonize police officers in order to get this passed. That is not good for the community. It's not good for our country. So outside of those two pillars, I'm going to negotiate on data collection, to negotiate on how we use the resources, to negotiate on decertification of officers versus the national registry versus the local retention of records. Those things we can negotiate on, but we can't demonize law enforcement because we can't stereotype every officer, because I don't want you stereotyping every black person.
So, if this legislation gets adopted,
yes,
and you've worked so hard on it and been an eloquent proponent of not only legislation, but talking to the issues that really seem to be dividing the country right
Absolutely.
Now, how much would this legislation, if adopted, kind of address the division of the country, or how much of it does it reside outside the particular policy that needs to be addressed in terms of police issues of police brutality, discipline, and the like?
Well, really great question, and I'll try to unpack it quickly. First, I would say is that, in my opinion, had the Justice Act been law, we could have had more resources for de-escalation training. Would that have changed Kenosha, Wisconsin?
Right.
I don't know. But it certainly would have had more arrows in the quiver, more tools in the toolkit for that situation. That's exactly the situation that needed to be de-escalated.
So facts on the ground. We need to create an environment where these cases are not happening, these killings aren't happening, these murders are just not repeating themselves.
Absolutely. But let us not be deceived. These are not, all of these are not federal issues. Mm-hmm. The Kenosha Police Department, like the Minneapolis Police Department, could have had police reform done in their cities. It doesn't take the federal government to come in and say, don't use a chokehold. It doesn't take it. All we need to do is to simply have local decision makers, city councils, do their jobs, mayors, do their jobs. They're asking the federal government to come up with a solution to some things that are not our problem. And that's really important to remember that.
And that's a mentality generally people look to Washington. But I imagine it has some influence when the federal government acts whatever constitutional way it can,
yes.
And then it kind of filters down across the states and localities. I mean, do you see that happening now?
I see that as a potential. Joe Biden has talked about what President Trump and I have already worked on, which is a national best practices. He's talking about something very similar now. He's following, it's interesting to have him follow President Trump and myself on this issue, this concept of the best practices through a national police commission. We embrace that because it's in the bill. And so I'm glad he wrote the bill. So literally, here's a chance for us to see things get better because 18,000 departments all need a high standard, and a high standard could be established through this National Police Commission.
When you are in South Carolina, in your state, and you're talking to police officers, and then maybe you've gone nationally or even here in D.C., right? What are they telling you?
Well, A, they're frustrated. B, they feel like they've been put into a very small corner with a very hard job to do. And frankly, you can see the manifestation of that in the response times in Atlanta right after the incident at the Wendy's. Out of the six zones, three of them had a very slow response time because now the officer feels in jeopardy. So they are thinking about their family, their homes, and that's not what we want them to do. We want them thinking about the situation.
Right.
But if you put them in that precarious position, you should expect humans to have a dual track. That's not good for anyone. And so we're seeing the manifestation of real challenging situations around the country. We can do better. We should make it easier to protect, create a moat, as I've said, around the officer, right, so that they will do the best job for the citizens without having to worry about their personal families, their personal assets, and the liability that comes with it.
Let's talk about the other side, sure, right? Those who have been victim of police,
absolutely,
brutality. Young people who are questioning whether they can rely on their institutions, rely on the police. What do you tell them as you engage those who are on the streets protesting as part of the Black Lives Matter movement? What are you hearing, and what is that conversation?
What I would say is that the guy who's been stopped, as I said a little earlier, 18 times in the last two decades, 7 times as an elected official in 1 year, 3 times last year, 2 times already this year, I feel your pain. I understand what it feels like to be accused of something that you did not do. It's one of the more dehumanizing things that you can experience. How we respond to that in a peaceful way is prudent and necessary. John Lewis, frankly.
Great civil rights activist, member of Congress recently passed, yeah.
He allowed me to be the co-chair of the 50th anniversary of the Pettus Bridge. Think back to 1965 when the police came to beat and brutalize the peaceful protesters. Fast forward 50 years, 2015, there we are together on Pettus Bridge,
wow,
being protected by the same law enforcement agencies that 50 years ago almost killed them.
Progress is what you're saying.
Unbelievable progress. The thing that's missing is a fair and balanced perspective on what has been and where we are now. Thank God we are not where we used to be, even though we're not where we want to be. And so when you have both on the table, you can see clearly the future.
And that gets to the kind of joke you make, I've heard you make on the Senate floor and elsewhere in terms of civics. Those who failed at learning civics,
yeah, I did.
I guess you've aced the course since high school. But we think about the education of our young people, how do we send that message? How are we getting that across in the classrooms and in communities?
It's It's one of the reasons why I really believe in education reform, mm-hmm. and the opportunity of education. I say it's the closest thing to magic in America is a good education. That means you need to have good curriculum too. And unfortunately today, you're not being taught how to think, you're being taught what to think. We have to change that as well if we're going to get a better outcome in the country, because there's a lot of ugly things in our past, but there's a lot of beautiful things who we are. And we should focus on both so that the average person, the average student, gets a full education on the beauty of America, even with the flaws that are in our system.
Diverse set of views, but allow that discussion to occur is what I hear you saying.
Plus, you have to be taught how to think, not what to think. I need to draw my own conclusions. Even though I had some liberal teachers in high school, they didn't teach me what to think. They taught me how to think. They did not try to indoctrinate me. They helped me come to an objective conclusion based on all the relevant information.
But as a parent, when I try to teach my kids what to think, I pretty much guarantees they will not think the way I'm telling them what to think, right?
Well, we can see the street chaos right now. So there's chaos in your home or chaos in your streets. Yes.
We're talking about opportunity, and one of the things I want to hit on before we conclude this conversation is another element of what you've done in the Congress that's had a consequential, substantial impact across the country, and that is these opportunity zones.
Yes.
Economic opportunity zones. Another component, you talk about the education layer, right, or pillar, and then you have the kind of economic and opportunity pillar. Talk about that for a second, how it kind of interacts with one another and where it's happening across the country.
So we have 8,700 zones around the country, which is great news. We have about $75 billion that are targeted for those zones already.
$75
billion? B as in boy.
Okay.
$1 billion. All private sector dollars. In other words, investors and entrepreneurs looking for ways to make a difference, long-term difference based on the way the legislation is designed in some of the most distressed communities in America.
Why? Why would someone who is, I can get the philanthropist.
Yes.
But why would the entrepreneur, why would the investor whose motivation is profit?
Right.
Why is that appealing to that individual?
Well, we follow the Adam Smith rule, the invisible hand concept, mm-hmm. that we want everybody participating in this economic system that leads to economic mobility. What we do for the investors, we say, we will defer and delay your capital gains tax. And even if you stick around long enough, which is 10 years, you can see the elimination of your capital gains tax if you make a long-term investment in one of the distressed communities.
So tax policy.
Tax policy, tax communities. Absolutely. And what that does is it brings job creators, not the government, but job creators into the communities to create jobs. And what we've seen, according to the president's advisors on economics, is an 8% increase in wages in opportunity zones. These are the most distressed communities, majority minority communities, that are now seeing an increase in their wages about 250% faster than the average wage increase pre-pandemic.
And that's measured nationally or in that same area?
National.
Wow.
In those 8,700 zones.
Give me an example that comes to mind of a zone that really speaks to you and that might kind of capture this policy conversation in the form of a real community, real people, real lives.
I have Sark Home, of course.
That's fine. Hampton, South Carolina flag behind you.
Heather Hill, Hampton, South Carolina, the largest actual investment, not money that's committed, but money that's in the ground now, $315 million, creating 1,500 jobs in a hydroponic, which is an agriculture building.
You saw my blank stare when you said hydroponic. Yeah. I didn't
know. Mind you, it's based on agriculture, the ability to do really cool things inside. And it's a $1,500 job creating
investment. 1,500 jobs. Wow.
$300+ million. And it's the first of its kind. So the future of agriculture, thank God it's in South Carolina, but it's also going to spread across the country. There's an HBCU, historically black college and university, in North Carolina that owns 300 acres in an opportunity zone. Oh, wow. And this hydroponic concept could easily spread to North Carolina and around the country. There's in South Dallas, there's a 2,000 new jobs, $400 million investment happening in south of Chicago. There's 3,000 affordable homes in Rock Hill, South Carolina. The mayor, a Democrat, who says opportunity zones are bringing affordable housing to the downtown area of my city for the first time in almost four decades.
So better housing, improved housing.
better housing, better jobs.
How does it connect to education? So what would happen to that community in terms of educational opportunities that we start our conversation?
Absolutely. So I'm working on a concept called opportunity education to marry with opportunity zones.
Okay.
So that unfortunately, a lot of these Title I schools, some of the poorest schools in America are located in or right contiguous with an opportunity zone. So can you imagine school choice, education reform, populating these opportunity zones so that the poorest kids in America have the best quality education, which leads them to high school, college, and beyond, or workforce training popping up in their backyards so that they get the requisite skills, they become a welder at $150 an hour, or a plumber at $100 an hour, or become an engineer at less.
So there's going to be this opportunity thing for education.
Yes.
Kind of the educational component to these opportunities.
That's what we're working on right now. Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's exciting stuff.
Senator, before we end this conversation, we're going to go just ask you kind of anything that comes to mind when you think about Ronald Reagan, maybe a book, a speech, or a quote, or any way he may have impacted you in your political life or before, something we always do in our discussions here.
Well, Ronald Reagan, Art Laffer, the Laffer curve.
Laffer curve, there we go.
Which is the inverse relationship that basically says that when it's on sale, you buy more. In the government, what that means is that when you lower taxes, you see an increase in production, but also an increase in revenues. So the Laffer curve, Art Laffer became my economics mentor when I ran for Congress. Because of Ronald Reagan, I learned about the Laffer curve. So in the end, in 2017, when I was assigned to be one of the four senators in charge of tax reform.
Right, tax reform bill.
The one thing I thought about was the Laffer curve, and what ultimately occurred is after we passed it in 2017 and 2018, with lower taxes, we had an increase of money to the Treasury.
Revenues went up.
In 2019?
Even more.
So Ronald Reagan, not only did he create Reaganomics and the greatest prosperity in a generation, we use the same concept.
Still holds true today.
40 years later, 35 years later, 1986 I think it was, to do it again.
Fantastic.
Do it again. Reagan's not.
Senator Tim Scott, thank you so much for
spending
time with us. We look forward to having you back and doing another round of discussion.
I look forward to it too.
Thanks so much.
God bless. Thank you.